Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and a warm welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with 30 minutes of South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast, interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Thursday, the 11th of July. Coming up on the program, reaction to the Life Esidimeni inquest finding behind the VBS looting scandal, how Stats SA got our most recent census count wrong, and as the Western Cape is engulfed in bad weather, the impact on schooling. Well, a just end, some say, to a tragic story. An inquest has found that the deaths of some of the mental health patients in 2016 were caused by the former Gauteng Health MEC, as well as the former head of Gauteng Mental Health. It's known as the Esidimeni scandal, and the inquest probed criminal liability for the tragic deaths of 141 psychiatric patients in the province. More now from Fatima Lahir, who is with the organization Section 27. Fahima, welcome and thank you very much indeed. This is the end of a very long and sad road. Do you think there's any sort of closure that has been achieved?
Hi, good day to you and your listeners. Thank you so much for having me. Yes, I think there was some kind of closure. We will never be able to restore lives and the lost lives and dignity. But what the inquest's judgment has done is it was able to enhance public confidence and reinforce accountability in governance. And I think a lot of the families were looking for accountability. And I think there is some kind of consolation in that.
So what changes, if any, then need to be implemented in the health department or in the broader mental health care system since that tragedy?
So according to the National Mental Health Care Act, there are standards that need to be put in place, and these standards are legislated and are there. It's just a matter of implementation. And what we've seen in Life Esidimeni is these home-based organizations which took in patients that were not ready for community-based healthcare, as there were patients that needed a specialized level of care. And I think it's just sticking in with the requirements that are legislated and following procedures.
But that is all predicated on better oversight. And I'm wondering if that is any better now than it was then, because there were huge deficiencies that were pointed out at the time.
No, definitely. But I think what this judgment has done is that it's held two high-level individuals to account. And this is something that's not usually seen, especially in relation to like an inquest. So I think that with this judgment, it speaks to political accountability. And it also acts as a deterrent going forward for political individuals who think they can make decisions without being held to account.
What further action do you think needs to be taken against those two high-profile individuals that have been named?
As per the judgment, these two high-level individuals, Dr. Manamela and the former MEC, Kedani Matlangu, have been recommended for prosecution. So we now hope that the National Prosecuting Authority, the NPA, will decide to initiate prosecution, charging these two high-level individuals with culpable homicide.
Fatima, we've still got to ask ourselves the question 6 years later, how such a large-scale transfer of patients to ill-equipped NGOs could have been allowed to happen. Because if I cast my mind back, and I remember reporting the story extensively, there were numerous warnings. There was expert advice warning against this.
Definitely. And as Section 27, we were involved in those initial negotiations. We were involved in writing to the department, explaining through expert evidence as to why this move shouldn't happen. But I think it was a decision made at a high level, and through the MEC enforcing this decision, everyone beneath her was forced to just implement a decision that she has taken. And I think that's what the judgment decided on. It was the termination of the contract with LE, despite the warnings, despite the expert evidence placed before the MEC, that she still took this decision. And I think holding her to account in the judgment is quite important and quite groundbreaking.
It's also about understanding the power that a budget can play in a process like this. And there is absolutely no doubt that the role of that budget did play a role in the decision-making process. And one's also got to ask the question how processes like this then can be improved going forward to ensure better oversight and accountability, because this cannot happen again.
Definitely, but it can also be seen that through the Ombuds report, Life SEDMENI was actually much cheaper compared to the public hospitals such as Westkoppies, Sterkfontein, etc. And it was obviously the community-based care was even cheaper, but not at the level of care that Life SEDMENI could provide. So when we talk about budget, it's important to understand it in the frame that Life SEDMENI was a better option.
And I'm assuming that Section 27 is still not satisfied with the reasons that were given by the MEC and also the former head of mental health.
No, definitely, because prior to the moves, Section 27 has engaged with the various political figures trying to stop this decision from taking place. And I think with the expert evidence put before Dr. Manamela and the MEC, the reasoning was just insufficient as to why these patients were moved.
And just finally, are you confident that the right changes are going to be made in government protocol to prevent something like this from happening again in the future?
I cannot speak to that. However, what we can speak to is Section 27, we will continue as an oversight body in terms of monitoring these types of cases, especially because of our expertise in mental health, and just making sure that this never happens again, and that we hope that this judgment acts as a form of accountability for political figures, for people in power who make decisions that affect others, and realize that they will be held to account for these decisions.
Thank you very much indeed. From Section 27, that is Fatima Lahir.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The man described as the kingpin behind the brazen looting of more than 1.9 billion rand from the VBS Mutual Bank, pleading guilty to 33 charges, including theft, fraud, money laundering and racketeering. The former VBS chairperson, Chifiwa Matodzi, has pleaded guilty as part of a plea and sentence agreement. So let's get behind this story. Joining us now is Kaya Koko, who is head of investigations at the Mail and Guardian. And maybe a good place to start is some background on the scandal and how Matodzi was involved.
So the first arrests were made in June 2020. It was Matodzi and about 8-9 other people. This was the top executive structure of the VBS Bank. The allegations are that between April to the end of March 2017, the bank siphoned about 2.7 billion out of it by falsifying financial statements and making fictitious credits in order to channel the money into their personal accounts. This was savings of people, mostly pensioners in the Venda Limpopo area. VBS, standing for Venda Banking Society, which was a mutual bank started by the royal family in the area. And so a lot of people lost quite a bit of money. They got some of it back, but it wasn't, I mean, for someone who lost 3 million rand to only get back about 50 to 100K is a major loss. So Chipiwa, who was the Amatodzi, who was the chairperson of the board, he's the one who pleaded guilty to 33 charges on Wednesday.
And in that respect, are you able to tell me what specific actions he was involved in involving the scandal?
Sure. There was a lot that he was involved in. For example, sometime in March 2017, this was the last leg of the alleged looting. Matodzi and a guy called Philip Truta was also pleaded guilty. He pleaded guilty in October 2020, and he's currently serving a 7-year jail term. He was the chief financial officer, and as well as two other executives. You know, they took out 262 million rand in 12 days by creating about 35 fictitious VBS credits. Matodzi yesterday pleaded guilty to 33 of those. The total sentence, because the monies involved corruption over 500,000 rand, they fall within the Minimum Sentencing Act. So he got over 400 years, but served concurrently. So he'll serve an effective 15-year jail term, as well as assisting the state in the remaining prosecution.
Do we have any indication as to what motivated Matodzi? He's a qualified chartered accountant, and he lived a comfortable existence.
I guess, you know, that he wanted to live a more comfortable existence, you know. There's no clear motivation other than greed. And that's what the state alleges as well for the remaining accused. But Matodzi, oddly enough, during his bail application, had said that he would plead not guilty to the charges, saying, and I'm quoting him, I intend to have my day in court in order to prove my innocence. So he's then made an about turn, because you would remember, Jeremy, prior to the criminal charges and the prosecution, that stemmed from a report and investigation by advocate Terry Motau, senior counsel, commissioned by the South African Reserve Bank into the missing billions of VBS. And so there's a lot of evidence that advocate Motau gathered and forwarded to the NPA, which did what it called a prosecution-led investigation. So prosecutors working with the investigators in a sort of focused and specialized investigation unit within the prosecuting authority. So this is the second conviction of something that started in 2017, 2018, and the state would be hoping for more. But it's been pretty slow.
Well, let's talk about that. In respect of this guilty plea, what impact has it had on ongoing investigations and prosecutions in this particular incident?
Well, it's bought the state more time and greater credibility, especially the NPA. You know, it hasn't been too successful over the years trying to prosecute certain big ticket corruption cases. So with this one, with VBS, you know, getting the chairperson of the bank confessing and agreeing to assist further in prosecuting the others is a major coup for the NPA. And it buys it more time with the public as well. You know, something to put out there to say, okay, you know, we are convicting. Yes, it's the long or the shortish arm, longish arm of the law is grinding slow, but we are moving in the right direction.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, unquestionably, there are broader implications of this case for the South African banking sector and the regulatory environment at large, I would suggest. The stolen funds themselves, are there further measures being taken to recover and compensate?
Well, yes, there are quite several, one of which is the liquidators of the bank suing KPMG for just over 860 million rand that it believes the auditing firm was liable for. There's also a KPMG accused within the prosecution. and so the bank was also, Sipho Malaba was the auditor for KPMG. It did the audits and passed off this, as the state alleges, and passed off the bank that the financials as clean, that there was no corruption while all of this was happening. So liquidators of the bank are trying to get just over 816 million rand from KPMG. It's also a civil case that is dragging slowly, but those are efforts to try and recoup some of the money that was taken from pensioners.
Kaya Koko is Editor Investigations at the Mail and Guardian. I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, scientists are criticizing government's latest census, saying it's so flawed it simply cannot be relied on for important aspects like resources and the allocation of budgets. I want to talk now to Professor Tom Moultrie, who's Professor of Demography at the University of Cape Town, and he would form part of that group. Professor, a very warm welcome to you. So let's start with this. What is your principal criticism?
So the principal criticism is that the census doesn't make sense nationally, provincially, at a district level, municipally. When we have a very good idea of what the population really should look like, that's what demographers do. We have past censuses. The UCT MRC team worked, you know, like Trojans during COVID to understand the pattern of deaths in the country. We've got a very good understanding of deaths and births in the country. We're past data. And so one can reconstruct what you think the population really should have looked like in February 2022. And the results released by StatsSA don't make and don't conform with those expectations, and quite dramatically so. And the problem underlying this is the extent of the undercount in the census. StatsSA is very good, and they follow best international practice by trying to and setting out to estimate what the undercount in the census was. But when they did that, they did that exercise, it was revealed that the undercount of 31%, which is incredibly high. It's the highest of any census ever reported to the United Nations Population Division by some 10 percentage points, double the undercount in 2011. And the size of the survey which is used to estimate that undercount is, we would argue, was massively underpowered to be able to cope with that level of the undercount. And that's why we see, for example, in the aggregate, we think they overcorrected the population by about a million people. But when you go down to municipalities, you find places like the Richtersveld in the Northern Cape, a very small municipality, which has notionally doubled in size between the last two censuses. And that doesn't make any sense.
So what does an undercount actually mean then in terms of impact and consequence?
So, all censuses will be affected to some extent by an undercount. You know, the census tries to count each and every person in a defined space at a particular point in time. No census is perfect. It's the data collected by humans on humans. But what the real issue here is that when you adjust the population for a 31% undercount, the data which you get out after doing that adjustment, after what StatsSA did, looks increasingly like whatever they estimated by various categories of the population, what that undercount was. And StatsSA has revealed that the undercount of the white and Indian populations in this country both exceeded 60%. And when you try and adjust the South African population for those levels of undercount at small areas for small populations, the results really do start to become troubling. And that impacts on things like the equitable share formula, which is used by National Treasury to allocate fiscal resources to the provinces and by the provinces to allocate resources to districts and municipalities. And that really matters, because if you get your population of a municipality or a district very badly wrong, that could lead to misallocation of resources or underallocation of resources for building hospitals, schools, clinics, provision of medical services, allowing businesses to make decisions as to where to locate factories. All of those things are ultimately impacted by the quality of the census.
Are you able then, as a result of this mistake, to work within the confines of the error, or are those numbers, when it comes to things like budget and resource allocation, simply locked in?
Unfortunately, over 2 years has now passed since the collection of those census data. And so what would be very hard to go back and run a larger scale survey to try and properly estimate what the undercount was. And so I think the results of the census are what they are. And I think that that's quite likely what StatsSA would say. Those are the results of the census. We think that those results are not helpful, for the kind of purposes to which the census is routinely put. And so one of the challenges which is going to be facing us now is to use our skills as demographers to try and come up with alternative sets of estimates of the population by age, by sex, at a district level, to provide an alternative view as to what the real state and the distribution and the size and scope of the South African population is.
What is the demographic community yourself included calling for now? Do you think that this needs to be officially investigated?
I mean, I think, in our technical report, which was published by the South African Medical Research Council, we draw attention to what we see as some of the major flaws which gave rise to this problem. The first was trying to run a census during the middle of a COVID pandemic. And I think that had demographers been asked at the time, the advice would have been to delay the census by another year or two. And that's the first problem. The second problem is that the original intent, going back to 2018, was to run the census largely as an online data collection exercise using a web portal and not having to mount a massive fieldwork operation. And as the COVID epidemic played itself out, StatsSA found itself having to run a major fieldwork operation. And then thirdly, there's the question as to what happened with the National Treasury. It would appear to us, looking at StatsSA's annual financial reports, that they'd asked the National Treasury to roll over some of the census budget into the 2022-23 financial year. And that request was denied, thereby forcing StatsSA to try and complete the census during the 21-22 financial year. So I think that the broad delineations of what might have caused this are well known. The question is really now is what measures can be put in place to make sure that the next census, which will be scheduled for 2031, doesn't fall prey to these same problems and does provide the crucial data which is required for policy and planning purposes.
So in that respect then, Professor, what steps should StatsSA be taking now to ensure a more accurate population estimate in the absence of this unreliable census, but looking at remodeling for 2031?
Well, I think they'd have to look at the modalities of data collection and try and make sure that that is kind of completely robust and reliable. I think one of the great failings of the 2022 census, and again, it was conducted in the middle of a pandemic, was the absence of kind of broad, widespread consciousness raising of the public to say, please get yourself enumerated. Why does it matter? And I think that was lacking. But in the very short term, I think the crucial challenge for StatsSA now is that every year towards the end of July, they release what are called the mid-year population estimates, which go down to a district level, showing, which can be used, by government for policy and planning purposes. And our first immediate suggestion is that they should not be trying to incorporate the results of the 2022 census in those projections, but rather to continue the series which they have done until there's been a process of full and careful interrogation of the data. We still do not have, as demographers, available to us data on births, which are collected in the census, the data on deaths, which are collected in the census. And we really need those data to be released by StatsSA to enable us to really understand what's happened here.
I am going to leave it there, Professor Tom Moultrie, Professor of Demography at the University of Cape Town. I do appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, severe weather conditions in the Western Cape have left well over 4,500 people displaced and as many as 15,000 structures have been damaged. The provincial government remains on high alert after the South African Weather Service updated its warning for today from a level 6 to a level 8, and that means disruptive rainfall. I'm going to talk now to Brona Casey, who speaks for the Western Cape Education Department, as we look specifically at the impact on schools. Welcome and thank you very much for joining us. So what specific difficulties are schools facing in terms of infrastructure and damage due to these rains? What have you been able to determine?
Yeah, there's been about 217 schools that have actually reported damages or disruption to their schools as a result of either the strong winds, which has been quite problematic in terms of, you know, uplifting roof sheets at, of classrooms and admin blocks. And that obviously causes further flooding if damaged. But then also just flooding itself, you know, and then access routes to schools. That is definitely a major problem that we are seeing now, especially after last night's rainfall.
So what's the advice then to parents, obviously for today and tomorrow, because this shows little sign of abating? Is it simply to keep your children at home?
Well, yesterday we made the decision to close schools in certain districts, which was quite widespread across the province. Except for the Eden Karoo district and some schools in the West Coast, but otherwise the rest of the province was closed, is closed today, I should say. But then tomorrow, we are making a call right now, actually, as to whether we will keep schools closed and in which districts. We've seen quite extensive damage to roads, actually, in the Overberg district as well as the Cape Winelands district. So we are meeting now to determine that, and that will be communicated probably within the next hour to schools and then to school communities via their principals and you know, channels, whether their schools will remain closed.
So obviously that means that you are coordinating closely with local authorities and disaster management teams.
Yes, 100%. We've just come off a meeting now with disaster management, the South African Weather Services, and you know, provincial, other local government agencies, as well as roads, road traffic authorities. And yeah, I think the big concern now is some of the flooding we've seen along the roads in those two districts specifically, and some of the damages that have been caused overnight with regards to flooding.
And also, I imagine, and not necessarily within your remit, but certainly part of your bigger responsibility, is ensuring the safety and well-being of both learners and teachers.
Yes, you know, we have to look at two aspects in terms of learners and teachers when they're in the school environment. You know, is the structure safe? And that is what we're trying to do. You know, as I said, we've got 217 schools that have reported damages. So we need to prioritize which ones need our urgent attention, which is very difficult when you've got these storms hammering us all the time and trying to fix them. But we're doing our best to try and address those urgent ones as a matter of priority. And then, of course, also then assess every day, you know, where there are risks in terms of learner transport to schools and access roads to schools for those teachers and learners. And that's when we are in contact with those road authorities.
And obviously beyond this, you need to put some sort of plan in place to make sure that education continues.
Yeah, we are very loath actually to close schools because of, you know, the protection of teaching and learning time, and that every single hour counts. So there will need to be catch-up programs in some schools, especially those that will be affected by a second day of closure, and those individual schools around the province that have requested closure. So those catch-up programs will have to be put in place, but we just ask that parents do, you know, when we saw quite a big absenteeism levels in the earlier this week, of learners not arriving at school just because of the heavy rains, you know, there shouldn't be an excuse to not attend school. But, you know, obviously where there is risks involved, that is understandable. Mm-hmm. But we need to also realize that, you know, that we are the Cape of Storms, and, you know, this is a reality every winter, and that we need to also be you know, accustomed to these kind of weather conditions.
Look, I know you're in the middle of this, but at some point you're also going to have to start turning your attention to support and resources to those affected schools in terms of a recover and a rebuild.
Yes, well, as far as the weather conditions, you know we're going to have a big storm coming on Friday, Saturday, and then we're just hoping that next week it will calm down, and then we'll just need to address the infrastructure issues at the schools. And as I said, we're already underway in terms of addressing repair work, you know, in terms of the schools that need urgent attention, and those would be the schools that would have longer term effects. So I think that is a priority for us at the moment.
All right, I do appreciate the update. That is Bronagh Casey, who speaks for the Western Cape Education Department. Just before we leave you, two other notes on the situation in the Western Cape. The first is that Eskom says as many as 25,000 of its customers are currently without electricity after this heavy rain and strong winds. The utility saying that the extreme weather is continuing to affect its network. According to Eskom, this has created major challenges for technicians. No surprise there, who are trying to get access to repair the those faults. Then I also see a note from the mayor of Cape Town, Jordan Hill Lewis, who describes the situation as mayhem, and he's quoted as saying the teams have been responding to as many calls as possible and are asking for patience. The mayor going on to say that strong winds overnight have damaged 14 homes in Wynberg, and the teams there are hard at work clearing obstruction and trees on roads right across the city. So that brings you up to date with the situation in Cape Town. Just before I go, our last online poll, South Africa's auto industry, I asked you if it was on the ropes, if it could recover, and if there was too much choice, perhaps as far as models and marks are concerned. Well, the preponderance of our respondents saying that the industry, while in a difficult position, certainly can recover. And that is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.